so you can kill my body. But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Welcome to Economics and Beyond. I'm Rob Johnson, president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking.
Say you can kill my body.
Say you can kill my body.
But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Say, no, you can't kill my mind.
You know we'll go away.
We're gonna go away.
Come back, come back, come back,
come back.
My second time.
I'm here today with Jacqueline Novogratz, who's an author, former Wall Street executive. She's founded microfinance firms in Rwanda in 1986. She's been a serial social entrepreneur. She worked with the Rockefeller Foundation on next generation's leadership. She founded a company called Acumen in 2001 that is both, I'll say, public and private, with social impact purpose. She's been an author of a wonderful book that many people have raved to me about called Blue Sweater, which was about her experience in Africa. But today, I guess on the front burner, in light of the tensions in our society on the cusp of the announcement of the winner of a presidential election in the United States, her book Manifesto for a Moral Revolution is what we'll largely explore. She's had time on Wall Street. She's had time thinking about human development, human purpose. It seems to me like, Jacqueline, I want to say right at the outset to our listeners, you are the kind of person that people should pay attention to your journey and to your insights, because we got to rebuild all over the world right now. And I thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Rob. It's a real pleasure. And thanks for what you do.
Let's start. I mean, this is an extraordinary time with this pandemic, what I've referred to as the unmasking of many, many things that people either went along with or internalized pain or even believed in. But there's something that's happened across many, many facets of what I'll call social unsustainability all over the world that are all coming to the surface. And I'm curious, what do you see? What gives you inspiration? What do you dread? What do you not see that you wish you saw? And what's the silver lining that we can draw from the power, the pressure, and the pain that's been inflicted upon mankind, humankind, at this time?
Well, you didn't start with a small question, Rob. thank you. You know, you said it with the unmasking is perfect. I would say that COVID has been a heat-seeking missile aimed directly at the poor and vulnerable. And what it has unmasked most, as you said, is the unsustainability of all of our systems, the gaping wounds of our health systems, our education systems, our food systems, our criminal justice systems, and how interrelated and interconnected they all are. It is caused a racial reckoning. And as you said, we're now in the midst of a presidential election where we've also seen exposed deep divisions in this imperfect world of ours, a dividedness and fear of each other. And so regardless of what side wins, this is an election that is much more about a sigh than a celebration, because we have so much work to do to repair. What potential and what inspires me is that through my organization, Acumen, I work with hundreds or nearly 1,000 change agents, social entrepreneurs around the world. And I have seen a pivoting and an acceleration of innovation to not only protect the poor, but enable the poor to get through and build new beginnings in ways that I've only dreamed of historically. But it's meant a different way of working. In Pakistan, India, East, West Africa, Latin America, where we work, you really saw a ripping off of the bandage. And there, what was clear to us was that while Acumen only invests equity and debt in entrepreneurial ventures, this was a moment for grants. And so we had to tap into a community that had given us investments and donations in the past, but this time asked them to do something different, which was to give grants to companies to protect really vital jobs. What's been extraordinary is to see people like Sara Syed Ghuram in Pakistan, who had built a tech telemedicine company, essentially, to connect low-income rural women with health clinics and through telemedicine, really great doctors, because 30% of Pakistani doctors stop working after they marry. But rural women didn't want to use an app for consultations. They certainly didn't want to pay for it. When COVID hit and government locked down the private health clinics, Sara felt like she had no choice, so she just changed. And she made the app free. She reached out to doctors, not just in Pakistan, but outside the country. And really within weeks, we saw what we had dreamed about for years, which was low-income people using an app, getting consultations with the highest quality doctors from around the world, and changing their ways. Government saw it too, and government then partnered with them. And I have examples like that, not only in the developing world, where the difference between keeping jobs and not keeping jobs was the difference between feeding your family and going hungry, but also in the United States, where we've seen private entrepreneurs flourish because they've dared to reach out to local philanthropists and citizens and governments in ways that I think can help us move to a place where we see ourselves more as citizens than consumers.
Well, how would I say that? Let's talk about how your journey informs what you would impart to people about how to succeed in the extreme anxiety and fear climate that we live in. What have you learned? I mean, being in Rwanda, the genocide, with the cruelty and so on, I can imagine some people, including potentially myself, being so terrified by what humans were capable of doing that I could shrivel up and go home.
Hmm.
But it's not the path you chose. You found inspiration to rise above or to not believe that was an intractable, how do you say, basis for legitimate despondency. What propelled you through the experience in Rwanda and on to Acumen?
I wasn't there during the genocide. I was there for years prior to the genocide. But I knew from many friends that the people with whom I had built this microfinance bank named Duterembere, which meant to go forward with enthusiasm. So you talk about unbridled optimism. I knew that the women had played out every role, not only being murdered, but bystanders, and in one case being one of the main perpetrators of the genocide. And I just had this need to try to go back and speak to people that I had worked with and loved and known for many years by then, to gain a bit more understanding. When I had been in Rwanda to build this bank, Rob, I was always confounded by the fact that these tiny microloans were great, but too few women were actually building businesses that employed people. So I thought, well, I need to understand what that's about. So I simultaneously started a bakery with 20 unwed mothers. And we were kind of the bad news bears, if you will. Rob? Did I lose you?
No, I'm just on mute.
Oh, sorry about that, because you went quiet on me. Okay, So should I go back?
No, that's fine. I listened to you, and I'll just put a little edit note here. But no, okay. I've been tracking right along. I just was
okay. Okay, sorry about that. We simultaneously started a bakery with 20 unwed mothers, and we were sort of the bad news bears. But it was an extraordinary little organization that I had built. And during the genocide, all 20 women were murdered. And I went to find the bakery with a friend of mine who had been a driver when I lived there before. And I couldn't find it. I couldn't recognize where it was. And suddenly I saw this blue paint, which was the color that one day we had decided to paint this bakery. And the blue paint was all over the sidewalk where we'd made a mess. And I knocked on the door and a woman answered it. And she didn't speak French, which was the language of the country. And I said, don't you remember there was a bakery here? Do you know anybody that knew it? And she had no memory of it because she had been a refugee from Uganda. And I went door to door like a crazy woman. You know, does anyone here remember this bakery that used to be here that was thriving with these women that were changing their lives and no one remembered? And that was a moment where I understood viscerally, not just intellectually, what the Jews mean when they say that someone has to tell the stories, to hold the memories. And that, you know, I was this white American kid growing up. You know, this was not, I never thought that I would be the one that would tell the stories, but I felt this deep sense of responsibility to tell the stories. And then the second piece, Rob, was sitting in the prison where Agnes, our first executive director, had was being held in solitary as one of the highest Rwandan officials in the genocide. And I went to meet her. And like all the prisoners, her head was shaved. She was in a pink dress. She had freckles. She looked much younger than she was. And as we were talking, and I was so nervous, I thought to myself, this is not what a monster looks like. And it dawned on me that monsters are just the broken parts of ourselves. And that in times of insecurity and fear and instability like now, it can be very easy for demagogic leaders to prey on those insecurities and fears and sometimes make us do terrible things. But inside all of us also are angels. And it is the work of our lives to build systems and cultivate within ourselves a sense of moral leadership so that we can bring out and celebrate those angels and suppress our monsters.
Wow, that's a beautiful insight. And how would I say, none of us is holier than thou. There are monsters and angels both within all of us.
In every single one of us. And in this time of so much division in the United States and frankly in every country in which I work, we have to remember that and not blame others for the problems that cause us to fear and cause us to pull inward because we need each other. In fact, we're all that we have is each other.
Experience a fearful situation. Some of my close friends know I witnessed a murder at gunpoint from about 40 feet away earlier this year.
I'm sorry.
And I always go back to a man who was a patient of my father's medical practice. His name was Marvin Gaye. And I always go to his song, "What's Going On?" We got to find a way to bring some loving here today. He says to his mother and to his father, and then as a member of society, organized anti-war movement, in the third verse, he said, we got to find a way to bring some understanding here today. And I think that the fear that makes you want to recoil and run away is something that we all have to resist. And I think working in groups, working together, as I've read in your book, is part of which you might call the essential nourishment to courage, which allows us to proceed.
I think that is so true, Rob. And I think a first step, which you're making me realize, also went back to Rwanda. In that healing is listening. And I think, and I write about it in the book, but I think that in those days after the genocide, I learned that listening is not just an act of love or an act of hope, but it's an act of activism. And I would sit sometimes for 12, 13 hours at a time listening to survivors of the genocide as well as perpetrators tell their stories. And it was some of the hardest work that I've done, because people essentially hand you the burden of their stories and you give them a real gift because you walk away with them. But you have to learn how to then release that burden yourself. And I think it was that time in my life that taught me in what you're saying with Marvin Gaye, part of learning to love each other again is starting by listening to each other again.
Yeah. I'm going to quote from one of my favorite books. I've used this quote frequently recently. The name of the book is Seasons of Grace by Alan Jones, who ran the Grace Cathedral in San Francisco, and John O'Neill, who is a management consultant famous for his book, The Paradox of Success.
Mm.
But in the Seasons of Grace, they are talking about the role of conversation. And Alan Jones describes a poster that he saw in his native country, England, about family life. And in the poster, he describes a parent is standing over a forlorn-looking teenager and says, "What you need is a good listening to."
I love it.
We all need not a talking to, but a listening to, an attentiveness, a respect for the things we say. That is a gift, is what Alan says in the book. And I think you're, how would I say, you and he come from the same pharmacy. Your prescriptions are the same medicine for us all. I really think that's right.
I think it's right. I think as humans, we yearn to be seen. We yearn to be heard. And right now it can seem that nobody's listening.
Yeah. And the disease that we might call otherness, where people kind of pull the walls up around themselves and demonize, whether it's gender or sexual preference, race, religious adherence or devotion. All these things seem to be ways of creating fault lines, which really aren't there, but they're there because our fear needs something for reassurance, and we have to find a constructive way out of melting those divisions rather than the fortification of them into little fortresses of the spirit. You talked, when we've talked a little bit earlier, about how do you build a moral compass? How do you create that North Star that propels you out of those fearful reactions? And in your work and in your most recent book, what do you see as the essential ingredients?
Well, I wrote the book because after 20 years of investing in entrepreneurs trying to solve our biggest problems of poverty, I realized that what separates those from those who build good, solid companies and those who change systems on behalf of voiceless people, poor people, vulnerable people, comes down to character. And that we're at a moment in history where there is no roadmap for how to build a new kind of capitalism, a new kind of solution to our problems. And so I would say you build the moral compass and that deep character by just starting, by not waiting around for a sense of purpose, but by seeing a problem and moving towards solving that problem on behalf of other people, not yourself. I often say that purpose doesn't come to people sitting at the starting blocks, but people who have the courage, to use a word that you had used, to take a step, to make themselves vulnerable, go into the unknown and see what they learn, and let that learning open up another step. And if you practice some of the skills that I talk about in the book, like listening, like seeing identity and learning to use it not as a weapon to divide, but as a tool to connect, learning to hold opposing values and even beliefs in tension, another skill that we don't see enough of our leaders using, learning to tell stories that matter, that these don't happen overnight, but these come by committing to something bigger than yourself and having the resolve and the grittiness to stick to it. And over time, if you hold to that North Star and hone those skills, before you know it, a moral compass develops.
Let me take our listeners on a tour. The quick tour of your book that really drew me in was when I looked at the table of contents and the chapter headings. Just start, redefine success, cultivate moral imagination, listen to voices unheard. You are the ocean in a drop. Practice courage, hold opposing values in tension, avoid the conformity trap, use the power of markets, don't be seduced by them, and I want to come back to that one. Partner with humility and audacity. Aren't those an interesting pair? Accompany each other. Tell stories that matter. Embrace the beautiful struggle. These pictures that you paint with words, I find so interesting in a world which has been taught that when you experience pain, that the way you alleviate that pain is to go make money, get some power, become famous. And yet, when I talk to psychologists, when I talk to friends, when I go through my own experience, I don't find too many powerful, famous, wealthy people that seem that happy. And so you're, but what the other side of this, you know, there are people who romanticize government. Some of that, I think, is what led to the abuses of Soviet communism. Mm-hmm. Others deify the market. They've transferred the from religious idols to the market, not as a tool, but as a deity. And then when you look at some instances where markets aren't doing so well, that faith in that deity contributes to your blindness. But as I looked through your book, and as I'm reading the different passages, you seem to be fascinated with innovation, fascinated with the tools of the marketplace. You have a lot of experience from very many vantage points, and yet you're using them as tools to align with a sense of moral purpose. And those, what you might call blankets that people wrap themselves in of money, fame, and power, which prove to be quite hollow in many respects. Your own work is part of the unmasking I think we need to go through.
Thank you for that. Yeah, I think that when we're young, we're so encouraged to go after the big three, money, power, and fame. We're egged on by these markers of a false success. And yet what really sets us free is committing to something bigger than ourselves And the harder we make it for ourselves, the deeper the purpose and the chance for meaning that we have. I remember, Rob, at one point before I started Acumen, a major financial institution asked me if I would consider instead setting up a white shoe philanthropy unit. And they were going to make me a managing director and pay me $1 million a year, which was a very tempting offer, I have to admit, given that I wasn't making any money. And I went through the interview process with a lot of different individuals. And I sat with one man and he looked at my resume and he was like, Rwanda, microfinance, Wall Street, like, I can't really make you out. And I said, really? And he said, I mean, what do you want to be doing? And I said, well, I've already told you what I want to be doing. And I said, well, what do you want to be doing? And he said, look, I have spent my whole life, you know, working for this institution so that I could have enough money to be free. And now I'm worth, and he gave me this astronomical number, more than $100 million. And he said, I can do anything I want to do. And I said, so what do you want to do?
He said, good question.
And he said, damn it. I don't know. You know, maybe I need to go back to school. And I was like, well, with all respect, I don't think that costs that much money. And I realized in that moment that in taking on these impossible problems that I will never solve in my lifetime, I had given myself a level of freedom that I hadn't even understood, because the world could never be confining, in part because I would never be successful in what I was setting out to do, not in that full way. And part of me would have to reconcile with the journey that I was on, with a sense of meaning that comes from the relationships I was building, the institution that I could be part of, even if the institutions got destroyed, the experiences that I was allowing. And instead of focusing on my own, you know, money, power, fame, beauty, could I focus on giving other people the opportunity to pursue their dreams, particularly those who've always been left out in every society? And at the end of the day, while nobody would accuse me of having a balanced life, they would also see a deeply joyful life.
That's a wonderful example. The Novogratz School of Navigation and Finding Your Life's North Star is the place where that man was enrolling in that conversation with you.
I think so.
He wouldn't have confessed his emptiness, despite his, quote, freedom, had he not sensed that you embodied the clues of what he was looking for. That's how I would interpret it.
That's so interesting. Well, and as I get older and I see people who are even older than me, the ones who hold that sparkle are the ones who keep a childlike curiosity, who are constantly renewing, and who are those who take on problems so big they don't solve them necessarily in their lifetime.
Yeah, what my friend and co-author John O'Neill, from the man who co-authored Seasons of Grace, talks about is lifelong learning. And he runs a seminar for people of our ilk called the Good Life Seminar, couple times a year, different places in the world. And he's drawing things out of Shakespeare and Dante and Homer's Odyssey and poets like Rilke. Tell me what if you were on the phone now, if I added John O'Neill to this conversation, what would you say should be on the reading list that... Given your experience, what resonates with the experience and the lessons you've learned that you've read?
Well, I'm going to answer it two ways. One is the books, but also in addition to creating the investing arms at Acumen, because we realized that this idea of crossing lines of difference and building the character that's needed to create real change and take on a status quo that doesn't want to change, we built Acumen Academy as immodestly called the World School for Social Change. And we've had about 1 million signups of people from all over the world who want to focus on change. With our fellows, and there are about 750 of them, we bring them through, interestingly, listening to John, Good Society readings, taking a leaf out of the Aspen Institute's Great Books programs. And those programs include deep readings from Plato and Aristotle through Khaldun, the Tunisian mathematician, and Chinua Achebe, and Gandhi, of course, Martin Luther King, because we're having a conversation about the essential principles of what makes great organizations, great societies, great human beings, not only with people in our own generation, but historically. And in putting that together, I did think about and draw from some of the great books that have had a deep influence on me that I would definitely want to talk to John about. And I would put Amartya Sen's Development as Freedom, which really laid the foundation for Acumen's understanding that access to markets is a form of freedom, but if you don't help build individual capabilities to interact with those markets, then they can also be oppressive and exclusive. And second, I would want to talk to him about Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, because as I saw with survivors of the genocide, that no one can make us prisoners if we dare to choose not to be. And that between stimulus and response, indeed, there is a choice. And I think that that in and of itself is deeply freeing and is at the essence of human dignity as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I had a quote that came to my mind from a speech I gave once by Adam Smith. He said, "By our very manner of talking about the world, we convert the imaginary into the certain." And by talking, by distilling your experience, you're bringing to the surface a model of something that at very least should inspire people's curiosity. And what I've really enjoyed in talking with you is this combination of vitality and humility. You talk so vigorously and, like you said, partner humility with audacity. And what's really interesting about that to me, I'm going to quote Margaret Atwood in the book she wrote called Alias Grace, and which Sarah Pauley in her documentary called Stories We Tell used as the epigraph. She said, "When you're in the middle of a story, it isn't a story at all, and only a confusion, a dark roaring, a blindness, a wreckage of shattered glass and splintered wood, like a house in a whirlwind, or else a boat crushed by the icebergs or swept over the rapids and all aboard are powerless to stop it. It's only afterwards, when that it becomes anything like a story at all, when you're telling it to yourself or to someone else." And you seem to have this gift to being able to distill your exploration and your audacity and your insight while maintaining humility, and you're producing a fantastic story. It's like a guiding light for the things that we need to embrace together now. And I think the word together matters a lot.
Well, thank you for saying that. Together matters a lot. And You also make me smile now because I love that quote, by the way. And I think that I have a capacity for failure and a capacity for enduring the uncertain. And when I think about, you know, when my organization, when Acumen makes a commitment to an entrepreneur, we're talking 10 to 15 years. That's a long time to accompany an entrepreneur who herself or himself is seeking. And so you go through valleys together. And there's an outside world that's looking in, many of whom are naysayers and think that what you're doing is a fool's errand at times. And so the humility comes from, frankly, knowing how hard change is, and from and being humbled and inspired by people who have nothing and would give you everything. And what you're trying to do is create a solution so that they can have their own choice and their own opportunity. But it could be 5, 6, 7, 8 years, and you don't know if the road you're on is going to lead you to real success, as defined by solving the problem with not thousands, but millions. And so this story of, you know, D-Light, these two guys with a solar light and a dream to eradicate kerosene, had those valleys, those tunnels. They were the ones that really endured. I came along to accompany them, to invest in them, to do what we could to support them. But now, you know, this is a company that's brought light and electricity profitably and affordably to 100 million low-income people. Now it's like, wow, that's amazing. But I know the real story. I know what they went through. I know what we went through. And I don't think you can go through that without retaining a sense of humility and wonder. Because
good word. Yes.
Right? Wonder. Yes. Because if you can do that, we can solve all of our problems. But we are seeing a world that I think because we're so afraid, not just of each other, but we're afraid of looking foolish. We're afraid of not being included. We have so much fear that we don't dare to do the really hard things. And it's time to change our definition of success, as well as to think about who we honor, because Silicon Valley has been famous for creating new needs as a way of you know, driving innovation to create new needs. And what excites me are those entrepreneurs who are driven to solve old problems. And goodness knows there are a lot out there. And not to do it from a place of what, you know, in our generation, Rob, people would say, well, you're do-gooders. What excites me and gives me hope is there's a new generation that understands that those old intractable problems are the most challenging problems of our generation. Mm-hmm. And those who dare to dive into them will have an intellectual, soulful, physical challenge of a lifetime.
You're really touching on something that you're bringing things to the surface of my imagination. You talked about money, power, and fame. I often think also about what you might call demagoguery or dogmatic authority, that people who are fearful go out and get all kinds of advanced degrees so they can put the armor of intellectual superiority to wrap around them and insulate them from the consciousness of their fear. Money, power, and fame have a similar notion. And one of the people, he's quoting the Bible, but there's a Nobel laureate in economics who once wrote, "Why is it harder for a rich man to enter into the kingdom of heaven than for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle?" That's the biblical quote. He then says, there must be a reason. Affluence breeds self-confidence, even to the point of arrogance. And I think intellectual armor does the same thing. But the person who said that was the Nobel laureate Paul Samuelson. And you're painting a picture for me, for us today, with a certain humility, but the person, the people, the society that you're embedded in is both emotional and intellectual. And it's that emotional dimension that people seem to be so afraid of, where someone like Muriel Rukeyser, she wrote a book called The Life of Poetry, and the first section was called The Resistances. And she says, because of our lack of appropriate aggressiveness, the meeting of emotional situations as they take form, we face a crisis, and one of our chief resources as human beings, the communication of feeling. That communication of feeling, as we talked about earlier, getting a good listening, feeling connected, feeling belonging, is part of what alleviates fear. And I think it does when it becomes a culturally profound dimension of your life. It's much better at insulating you from fear than your advanced degrees or the number of zeros in your bank account.
That is truly profound. You know, we have a partnership where I say our company has created more covenant than contract with an indigenous group in post-conflict Colombia called the Arawako people. And this is a young entrepreneur, Carlos Velasquez, and Mayumi Ogata from Japan, he was from Colombia. And they wanted to try and build a premium chocolate company in Colombia. And where the Arawakos live can be found this white cacao or cocoa, one of the rarest in the world. And so they had to build trust. And before the Arawakos would sign on to this partnership, it was very important to the spiritual leaders, the mamos, that they meet the people that they would be involved with, including the investors. And so I went, even though the real investor is, you know, our guy, Virgilio Barco in Colombia, I went down to meet with the mamos. And for 3 hours, I listened to the cosmology of the Arawako people. And it was incredible, Rob, to what you're saying. Not only the sense of community, but the sense of collective purpose, that they see themselves as the elder brother. And we, the rapacious capitalists West, are the younger brothers. And when he finally explained why they would enter into this partnership, because he does want solar, he wants some things for his community. He said, you know, we were people that took the time to know who they were, who built trust. But make no mistake, he said, the minute you send our community out of balance, we will stop this. And I thought to myself, you know, this is a man not intimidated by the money on the table, not intimidated really by anything, who was willing to tell me who he is and who his people are. And we were entering that transaction, it wasn't a transaction. We were entering that relationship as learners, as givers, not just takers. And I think that that's also at the essence. And my prediction in this next chapter of American history is that, or maybe it's my hope, Rob, that we will ourselves discover a new humility and realize there is so much to learn from other cultures, not only about the building of community, but we will be importing innovation from resource scarce environments who solve problems in ways that really bring forward our humanity.
Yes. Yes. Do you see, from your experience in Africa and the acute concerns in the United States now, which you might call different challenges? Or are we now a globalized world system where, which you might call what the advanced country Cartesian Enlightenment West imposes on the world defines all of our challenges?
Yeah, I would say both in some ways. I think I grew up in a world of much more separation, where we had rich countries and poor countries, capitalism and communism, as you said, where the nonprofit sector and the for-profit sector, and we're seeing a great convergence where there are elements of the for-profit and the nonprofit and the developed and the developing in every nation on the planet now. When you compare literacy rates, hunger rates, maternal mortality rates in certain pockets of the United States, they compare not just on a relative basis, but on an absolute basis with regions like Southern India. And that really surprised me when we started Acumen America, because I had assumed we would be looking at the poverty inequality, which would be different. But in fact, there is absolute. The poverty of inequality in the United States, however, is a different problem than the unequal, but also deeply absolute poverty that you see in parts of Africa and South Asia. There's an isolation, a loneliness, and I think the pandemic has been mirrored by a double pandemic of anxiety, depression, that has only been reinforced and exacerbated in this period. Whereas in other more communal-based nations, while it's been horrendous to have people living in such proximity to one another in terms of infection rates, people really grow up and live in community, and you don't have that pandemic of loneliness. Some of the countries in which we operate have a different kind of corruption. You see corruption certainly in the United States and made manifest in many different forms. But in some of the countries in which we operate, the court systems are so broken that it becomes incredibly difficult to navigate, to register land. I've learned more about sabotage, extortion, speed money, straight out bribery than I ever thought I would in my lifetime by doing work. And so in some of the communities in which we operate, and so finding those morally grounded entrepreneurs who stand on doing the right thing rather than the easy thing, not only is, first it's a challenge, and then it's a privilege that you get to accompany them. But it also means we have to find ways to really be a different kind of support system to one another.
When I was reading through your book, there's an essay. It was delivered as a speech, so it's a transcript, in Nebraska about 8 or 9 years ago by a gentleman who was an astrophysicist who left astrophysics to become an artist. His name is Enrique Martinez Celaya. And I remember a number of quotes from that, but one of them that I, as I was reading your book, that caught my fancy, he says, "We live in a narcissistic age. We see what is convenient to see. And ethics are less important than opportunity. Some may argue it has always been this way, but it's hard to deny the combination of our insolence and our means is unprecedented. Some may cheer our whims as an aspect of our freedom, but there's no liberation in whims. Rather, they are the mechanism by which we become enslaved. The freedom that is indispensable for human completion will not be found in the voyeurism of reality television or the indulgence of a customized lifestyle. Those prayers to the false god that he was seeing appeared to be what you might call part of the coldness or the things that's produced the fault lines and dysfunction, which you have been on your journey emerging, you've almost been defying with the courage of your own pathway. But I think the pandemic now, what I refer to as the unmasking, is bringing the insights of Celaya from 9 years ago to the surface. And there is potential for people like yourself to be leaders in a very large-scale healing. Not alone as a superstar, but by the very nature of community and purpose that you're exploring.
Thank you for saying not as an individual. I've come to think that, you know, we don't need another hero. Like you said, we need a million heroic acts. And I think you're right. You're reminding me of one of our companies in Los Angeles. A Wall Streeter named Sam Polk moved there to start to really do something about food deserts, because it's so impossible to get affordable, healthy food in Compton, or was. And after trying with the nonprofit, he realized he needed to have something that delivered quality food to people. And so he built a fast food, affordable, nutritious restaurant called Every Table. It was so popular and provided a lot of jobs in the community that it grew to 8 different restaurants. And so on lockdown, Sam went back to what you talked about at the beginning of this conversation. He went back to his North Star and he was like, wait a minute, I started this company not to make money, but to bring nutritious, affordable food to people. And so pretty impulsively, he put a tweet out that said, you know, we're here to make sure people get affordable, nutritious food. If we can deliver to you, let us know. If you can't afford to pay, let us know and we'll deliver it anyway. And if you're willing to pay it forward, click here. And within a few weeks, they delivered over 100,000 meals, largely from the generosity of people in Los Angeles. And then when Governor Newsom connected homeless people with hotel system, they contracted or partnered with Every Table. And by now, they've delivered well over 3 million meals across the city, significantly expanding jobs, and more important, or as important, giving everyday people the opportunity to help each other, to contribute. And I think we're going to see more examples of collaborative businesses in this way, that might start with a private sector entrepreneur, but that grows into tapping into opportunities for citizenship and crowdfunded philanthropy, partnership with government, but much more grounded in a sense of community and service.
We were talking in preparing for this about the arts, and you quoted a line or a passage from Rilke, and I found it very moving, and I think I mentioned to you, I'm getting ready for the plenary of my Young Scholars Initiative, and I'm reading his book, Letters to a Young Poet. But I was curious if you recall the lines from our earlier conversation.
Of Dare to Live the Questions?
Yes. Yes.
I can't remember the whole piece, but he talks about daring to live the questions now, because then gradually, without even noticing it, you will live into the answers. And he talks about, you know, if I told you the answers now, you wouldn't understand me.
Right, right.
So dare to live the question.
Yes.
And I think that that is, it's the seeker's way. The Sufis, Rob, say, start on the path. No, period. it's take a step.
Yes.
Wonder, ask questions. My mentor John Gardner used to say to me that it's more important, Jacqueline, to be interested than interesting.
Mm. John Gardner was a very close friend of John O'Neill, the gentleman who co-authored Seasons of Grace. I've not met John Gardner, but I've read many things of his at John O'Neill's suggestion.
And this is actually a different John Gardner, Rob. This was John Gardner who he was an extraordinary man, my mentor. He was actually the only Republican on Lyndon Johnson's cabinet. And he, interestingly, was the head of health, education, and welfare during the civil rights movement. And so John would tell me stories about meeting with Martin Luther King. And he was this, you know, very patrician, white man from California who'd been head of the Carnegie Foundation, was a funder of Sesame Street, and had such moral character that not only, you know, was he on this, I think we need today, a unity cabinet, but he really stood for civil rights in extraordinary ways, was a bridge builder. He started the White House Fellows. But at one point, he disagreed vehemently with Johnson's continuation of the Vietnam War. And so he resigned from the cabinet and he started Common Cause at age 54, a citizens grassroots movement. And it's that same kind of leadership that Seamus Heaney would talk about, you know, that we should elect the leaders who shed tears when asked. I miss him in this time of such tumult.
I believe that's the same John Gardner that John O'Neill referred me to.
Really?
Yeah. I remember the first book that I read of his was called Self-Renewal, The Individual and Innovative Society. And then In Common Cause, and a book on leadership.
John Gardner from Harvard, because you talked about him in the present. John.
Yeah, and he was a PhD in psychology from Cal Berkeley, which is where John O'Neill got his PhD before founding the California School of Professional Psychology. But that's fascinating. John W. Gardner, yeah.
Of course. Yeah.
Oh, you. How would I say? You come from a very nourishing mentor, that's for sure.
And, I have conversations with him all the time.
I had asked you about the questions, and Rilke, and I had two motivations. One was that my young scholars have dedicated their conference that's coming up that begins tomorrow morning on defining the 100 most important questions. And I may write to you tonight and ask you to submit three for their consideration, because that's what almost all of the keynote speakers who we had known and had invited many months ago are contributing, including Pope Francis, by the way. And but the other reason I brought up Rilke and that artistic dimension is because I had quoted Celaya earlier about the narcissistic society, but there is a passage in his notion of the prophet, the prophetic, prophet with a PH, not with an FIT, as they say, which reminded me of you. And I wanted to share with our listeners what you're reading inspired me to see. It goes like this. Art, which is many things to many people, is just one thing to me. A whisper of the order of things that dismantles consciousness and suggests my place in the world. This whisper of the order of things is not meaning. It offers a point of reference from which the measurement of meaning makes sense. Meaning that has answers to questions of my place in the world, of the choices I make, and of my relationship to others. The whisper is faint, but the best art helps us to hear it. It has nothing to do with the realm of perceptions, rather the invocation of a great order in the face of nothingness is fundamentally an ethical experience. As I followed your writing and your description of yourself in this conversation, that I think that passage embodies a great deal of the power and the depth of the journey that you're on. And I really do want to thank you for sharing with us today your way of seeing, your courage, your purpose, and your example. Because, how would I say, these are times that need North Stars. And you're certainly, how would I say, you're in the sky and you're glistening. And someone I want to encourage everyone to follow and to join arms with you and help you on your path.
Goodness, Rob, I'm deeply, I don't know what to say. Thank you. Except that we're all made of stars, aren't we? I wonder if I might ask for your indulgence to read the manifesto that we wrote as a statement of values that that we use to guide the work that we do in trying to build all of these companies serving the poor. If we don't have time, that's okay.
I would be delighted. How would I say, to have that North Star burning brightly and glistening through the words that you've created is an ideal way to conclude. So please.
Thank you so much. You've read so much beautiful poetry and so many quotes that I was scribbling down because I want to read this and could talk for hours. So I just thank you deeply for this conversation. But we wrote this, as I said, to try and articulate our moral compass. It starts by standing with the poor, listening to voices unheard, and recognizing potential where others see despair. It demands investing as a means, not an end, daring to go where markets have failed and aid has fallen short. It makes capital work for us, not control us. It thrives on moral imagination. The humility to see the world as it is and the audacity to imagine it as it could be. It's having the ambition to learn at the edge, the wisdom to admit failure, and the courage to start again. It requires patience and kindness, resilience and grit, a hard-edged hope. It's leadership that rejects complacency, breaks through bureaucracy, challenges corruption, doing what's right, not what's easy. It's the radical idea of creating hope in a cynical world, changing the way the world tackles poverty and building one based on dignity.
The word courage, which I heard you use many times in our conversation today, its Latin definition, let's break it down into the pieces. Cor, which is heart, and age, the time. And the original definition of courage was to tell the story of who you are with your whole heart. And I think you've done that in your writing. You've shared that with us today. Your manifesto is an embodiment of that vision. And my role, I'm grateful to say, is to encourage to try to support the strength that you've cultivated in the example that you set. Thank you for being my guest today. Thank you for inspiring me and sharing with all of our listeners. I hope to have you on again before too much time passes. There'll be plenty of challenges right in front of our eyes, and I will look forward to consulting you on how to navigate through the stars in the future.
Together.
Yes,
together. It'll be my privilege and my honor, Rob. Thank you for your wonderful questions, the way you listen, and the work that you do, and the way that you spread ideas and wisdom.
Well, I'm going to say, you know, a little bit of a personal comment, but being the host of a podcast is the best school I ever attended.
Well, lucky you.
Thanks again.
Take
Bye-bye.
Care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You too. And check out more from the Institute for New Economic Thinking at ineteconomics.org.
And I'll tell it and speak it and think it and breathe it. And reflect from the mountains so all souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking. But I'll know my song well before I start singing.